From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Ebola is spreading. Can it be contained? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Almost 700 people have died, more than 1,000 have been infected, in the worst epidemic since the Ebola virus was discovered in 1976. So far, it's confined to three West African countries with weak institutions, making it spread political as much as biological. We'll hear about a horrific disease with no cure and widespread fear, not just of Ebola, but also of Western doctors and their unfamiliar procedures. U.S. officials say it can be controlled if it ever gets here, but the epidemic is a massive challenge to global protection of public health. Today's talking point is the fast food industry on the path to unionization. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with To the Point. Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia lack education, solid infrastructure, or government institutions. That's made it hugely difficult to keep the biggest outbreak of Ebola from spreading. Is a deadly disease with no cure spinning out of control? We'll hear about that. Today's talking point, a new ruling says the McDonald's Corporation is responsible for working conditions at all its individual franchises. We'll hear how that could disrupt long-time practices in the fast food industry and possibly lead to unionization. First, this news update, a stunning report from the U.S. Commerce Department after many months of dismal news about the economy. Growth from April through June is estimated at 4%. That's enough to make economists upbeat. Here's Mark Zandi with Moody's Analytics. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Warren.
We haven't heard very many upbeat reports from you lately. Tell us what happened.
Well, it was a good quarter. Clearly it comes off a very bad quarter. GDP declined in the first quarter. So I think the reality is somewhere in between. You have to average the two, and it shows an economy that's growing about 2 to 2.5%, which is pretty much the growth rate that we've been experiencing since the recovery began about 5 years ago. So, you know, I'll take the good number, but probably overstates the case.
So 4% then in the second quarter doesn't necessarily mean 4% in the third and fourth quarters.
It doesn't. It does feel like the economy is on a better trajectory. Growth is picking up, and the job market in particular feels a lot better. So I think we're headed in the right direction, but I don't think we're in a 4% world. We're probably still in a 2.5% world headed to 3.
Okay. What about cars? What have they had to do with this?
Well, that was one of the really positive parts of the report. Consumers, households are out there buying vehicles, and vehicle sales now are back to their pre-recession level. So we've come all the way back to where we were. And that's really juiced up activity in the auto sector. That's creating a lot of jobs, good-paying jobs in parts of the country that have been really hard-pressed. So that's a very good positive sign. People don't go out and buy cars unless they're feeling more confident, and that's key to future growth.
Does that mean also that there are more people with jobs?
It does. And, you know, that's the most positive thing. We are seeing much stronger job growth. In fact, we've created 1.5 million jobs in the first half of the year, so that's we're on track to create 3 million this year if everything kind of sticks to script. And that, by any historical standard, that's pretty good. You'd have to go back to the mid part of the last decade to see that kind of growth, or even back further, you'd go back to the tech boom in the late 90s. So the job market is feeling a lot better. It's kicking into higher gear, and I think that augurs well.
So is it keeping up with the growth in available employees?
Well, there is signs of some growing labor shortages for particularly skilled workers. I think that's still quite modest. There's still a lot of slack out there. But in certain key jobs, skills, occupations, we are starting to see some labor shortages. That probably will become more prevalent as we go forward. And it does become an issue when we think longer run. We need to think about, are we going to have the workers with the skill sets necessary to power our growth in the long term?
I understand that a lot of this had to do with inventory accumulation, a lot of the growth that took place in the second quarter. What does that mean? And once again, what does it mean for the future?
Okay, so there was a lot of good news, but it wasn't all positive. There's some negatives. One negative was a source of growth in the second quarter was inventory accumulation. So what that means is that businesses produced more than their customers consumed, and so we saw more things pile up on store shelves and in warehouses. Now, of course, that means that going forward, that businesses aren't going to need to produce as much, and that's a negative. So that big inventory gain in Q2 steals away from future growth. But I wouldn't place too much weight on that. It's a negative, but I don't think it's an overwhelming negative.
What about housing?
Well, that's key to a much stronger economy. The housing market did add to growth in Q2. Housing construction was a bit stronger, and that added to growth. My own view is that we are going to see much stronger construction going forward, that there is a lot of households that are going to form, younger households, 20-somethings that have doubled up with their parents because they couldn't find work. But as they find work, they're going to start households, and they're going to need to live somewhere. A lot of it's going to be multifamily rental, but nonetheless, it's going to be a lot of construction, a lot of jobs, and I think that's going to be a lot of economic juice as we make our way into next year.
Is the Fed going to be looking at increasing interest rates?
Yes, not this quarter, not next quarter, but by this time next year, I think if everything kind of hangs together and the economy continues to improve, as I anticipate, the Fed will begin raising interest rates. The key for them is the unemployment rate, the slack in the labor market more broadly, and ultimately wage growth. They want to see wages begin to rise more quickly, at least at a pace that's above the rate of inflation. That hasn't happened yet. Until that happens, they won't raise interest rates. But if everything kind of hangs together by this time next year, that all that will come together and we will see rates start to rise.
All right. So then there was a growth of 4% during the second quarter. But Mark Zandi, as chief economist at Moody's Analytics, you're still dealing with a dismal science. What's the real bottom line?
The bottom line is the economy is steadily improving. A year from now, it should be meaningfully better. And I think a couple of years from now, we'll be close to full employment and feeling about as good as we felt in a very long time.
Great to hear from you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Warren.
In a moment, Ebola is spreading. Can it be contained? On To The Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point. Ebola was first discovered in 1976, a virus that first causes flu-like symptoms that quickly evolve into vomiting, diarrhea, and both external and internal bleeding. As many as 90% of those infected in previous outbreaks have died. Now, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, three of the world's poorest countries, are in the midst of the worst epidemic so far. At least 670 people have died. More than 1,000 others have been infected, including doctors and other medical personnel. Claire McDougall is a journalist based in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. Claire McDougall, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote recently in Foreign Policy an article that was entitled Death and Denial in the Hot Zone. Explain that title.
Sure. I think one of the major issues in Liberia regarding Ebola has been the issue of denial. Many people are in denial that it actually exists. So that was basically where the title of the article came from.
Why do they deny that it exists when, in fact, people are dying from it?
I think there's many, many complex reasons for why they deny it exists. Particularly in Monrovia, in the capital, there are a lot of allegations about government corruption and, people have don't have a whole lot of trust in the government. So, you know, there have been claims that the government has cooked up this, you know, just to get money from donors. And then in the rural communities, you know, there's more sort of, I guess, superstitious beliefs about you know, what people are doing. And, you know, there's suspicion that that people are taking people off to clinics and injecting them or killing them, and that the chlorinated spray that they're spraying, you know, the communities with is killing them as well.
So I take it they have to take relatively radical measures in order to deal with this virus, which is highly contagious. What do they do? What sorts of things are people reacting to negatively?
In terms of the measures that the government has taken?
Yeah. When you're in a village and the people come in to deal with your Ebola, what do they do?
Sure. So, I mean, there was an incident on the weekend, you know, that happened on Sunday. So Samaritan's Purse has been running the treatment centres, and they went into a community in northern Liberia to get a body, to retrieve a body of someone who had died from Ebola. And their vehicle was attacked. Four of their staff members had to run out into the bush. One of them was beaten brutally with a hammer, and you know, they were basically sort of, it was a siege, you know, from the sounds of it, it was a siege-like situation. And you know, thankfully their workers managed to escape alive, but that's, I guess, an example of something that's happened in rural areas.
So people are not just mistrustful of the government, but also of the very medical workers who are coming to help them, is that right?
Indeed. And another example would be, you know, Samaritan's Purse had a clinic in Monrovia, and the community surrounding the clinic basically resisted them expanding the clinic. Currently, you know, the clinic is basically at maximum capacity, and, you know, they can't accept any more patients. And they have been trying to expand for a number of weeks, but the community surrounding them, you know, are very sort of suspicious about what's going on. They're also concerned that they might contract Ebola if the clinic is too close. So that's another issue.
Claire McDougall, again, a journalist based in Monrovia, Liberia. Dr. William Fisher is a pulmonary and critical care physician for the University of North Carolina. He was deployed to Guinea on behalf of the World Health Organization. Dr. William Fisher, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Tell us what it's like if you're a clinician such as yourself trying to help people who are suffering from Ebola in these countries, which have weak institutions and very little in the way of medical facilities themselves.
Absolutely. I can tell you that it's an intense experience, and it's incredibly emotionally taxing as well as physically taxing for many of the reasons that you mentioned. One, there's a complete lack of resources. So the things that you typically have available to you to take care of patients who are this sick, are such as labs and clinical monitoring tools are not available at all, and so you're essentially flying blind with a deadly illness in the middle of Africa. The other thing is that the very suits that keep you safe can be incredibly limiting, both in terms of the ability to deliver care, as well as in terms of your own health. You lose about, the temperatures inside these suits are incredibly high. I think I measured 40 degrees Celsius on one occasion, which is about 115, 116 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's incredibly hot. And so you lose about 3 to 5 liters of sweat in that suit every time that you go in. And if you can imagine working in those conditions, trying to help somebody through a deadly illness, it's incredibly difficult.
Looks kind of like a spacesuit, I gather. Is it also something that inspires fear in some of the people you're trying to treat and their relatives and others around the community?
Absolutely. I think community mistrust is a major obstacle that Claire just remarked on and that you've brought up. And the suits don't help with that either. It takes away all of your human features, essentially, because not a single inch of skin is exposed. And so the things that typically provide comfort to a patient, like the touch of a human hand or the ability to display empathy with facial expressions, those are limited by the restrictive nature of the suit. Yet on the other side of that coin, that suit is exactly what allows you to focus on patient care, because it provides you with a sense of security.
even at the risk or not or the discomfort of 115 or 116 degrees inside. How effective, then, is the treatment that is being provided by the World Health Organization, Doctors Without Borders, and others?
So I'll say first that I think the work done on behalf of healthcare workers in this area, especially Doctors Without Borders, is heroic. There are no specific antiviral medications that are currently licensed, and there are no specific vaccines against Ebola that are currently licensed. There's a number of them in the current R&D pipeline, but nothing is licensed to be used right now. And so what we're left with is supportive care. And actually, one of the reasons that the World Health Organization sent me there as a critical care specialist was to see if we could improve the level of clinical supportive care using critical care techniques. And so and this was something that intrigued me about going and seeing if we could improve the care. And actually, I'm totally sold based on my experience there with aggressive clinical supportive care, we can reduce mortality. And I think that'll do a lot towards improving the trust that the community has in healthcare workers if we can demonstrate that patients do get better.
Did you get the sense that a lot of people who might have been helped weren't showing up because they either feared the disease itself or feared the way that their communities would feel about them if it were rumored that they, in fact, had the disease?
Absolutely. This delay in presentation is a major obstacle, both to the survival of the patient as well as to the ending of the outbreak, because patients will continue to obviously transmit if they're symptomatic. So on a number of occasions, I had patients who had tried to flee into the bush to avoid being taken into a treatment facility. In fact, the first two patients that I saw were a brother and sister who had fled into the bush, and the only reason that we were able to get them into the treatment facility is that they became too ill in the bush to be able to run away any further. And unfortunately, they presented too late in their illness for us to be able to get them through it, and they died despite everything that we knew how to do.
There's no vaccine, there's no cure, but you can be treated and survive Ebola. How does that happen?
Well, the patients are typically presenting with very low blood pressures due to volume loss, and that volume loss is occurring through vomiting and diarrhea. So they're essentially becoming severely dehydrated, and that's what's causing their blood pressure to be lower. And so if we can get them early enough where they don't actually become hypotensive and they don't become critically ill, we can aggressively support them with IV fluids and electrolyte replacements. And give them every chance to get better. Now, we aren't able to reduce their mortality to zero, but based on my experience, we can substantially reduce that mortality with aggressive clinical supportive care.
If you can get to them.
Yes, sir.
Dr. William Fisher, again, at the University of North Carolina, describing his experience in Guinea. Laurie Garrett is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's author of Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Laurie Garrett, good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren.
What about or tell us a little bit about the history of Ebola, first of all, if you will. Discovered in 1976. What's happened since then?
Well, first of all, I have to apologize. I have a cold, so if my voice is a little hoarse, apologies to all.
You sound fine.
The 1976 outbreak was the first time the world recognized the existence of this virus. It no doubt is an ancient virus that has circulated in African rainforest regions, tropical regions, primarily in bats, for millennia. Very occasionally, what has happened in 76 and since, you have an interaction between villagers, typically in a remote rural area, and the rainforest zone in some way that puts the individual in contact with an infected animal. There have been outbreaks, small ones, for example, that were the result of a family finding an ailing chimpanzee on the road, killing it, eating it, and then everybody in the family gets Ebola. Not every single outbreak has it been possible to say this is specifically the interaction with animals that resulted in this outbreak, but enough of the cases have provided us with clues that we know basically how the initiation of an outbreak starts. Now the question is, how do you keep it from turning into an epidemic? And in the past, that's been relatively easy because the outbreaks have all been in very remote areas, mostly rural, or in the case of the one I was in 1995 in Kikwit, Zaire, it's a large community, more than 450,000 people, but almost impossible to get in and out of the region. So there was no particular risk, or let's just say the risk was incredibly small, that any of these prior outbreaks would somehow turn into a larger phenomenon that would risk urban areas and even cross borders. So what makes Warren this one utterly unique and just defying all the easy solutions is three characteristics. One, it's not only rural, it's also urban. So it's also in the most densely populated areas in the three affected countries. Number two, it is in three countries. It's not in one country as every other prior outbreak was. And that means three governments, all of them very weak governments, have to figure out how to collaborate, how to have uniform policies, and how to work with external agencies and groups like Médecins Sans Frontières. And there's no uniform policies. And then the third is, excuse me, this outbreak is occurring in an area that has in recent time experienced the most brutal civil wars of modern history, in which about 400,000 people were slaughtered between 1985 and 2003. The former leader of Liberia is in prison as a war criminal. These were wars that involved child soldiers sent into the villages of their own people to chop off arms and legs. The brutality was unparalleled, and it has left scars across all the clans, all the families, all the tribes, and cutting across the borders. It makes it incredibly difficult to have any trust built in any health response at all.
Laura Garrett again at the Council on Foreign Relations. So, Dr. Fisher, back to you. We can see the background that you were that led to some of the problems that you described earlier.
Absolutely. And I think Dr. Garrett did a phenomenal job of highlighting what makes this outbreak so complex. And I'd reiterate that that this population in Western Africa, specifically within these locations, are much more mobile than previous centers where outbreaks have occurred, and that mobility seems to be sustaining this this epidemic. And what I often say is that diseases and infected patients are able to cross these international boundaries with ease, but resources and collaboration are not.
We'll talk a bit later on the program about how Ebola is transferred from one person to another. But very quickly, Dr. Fisher, is it possible that it passes through the air? So should people worry, for example, about somebody getting on an airplane that might have Ebola?
So the epidemiologic studies do not suggest that it's airborne. Most Ebola looks to be transmitted mostly through direct or indirect contact with infected bodily fluids such as vomit, diarrhea, blood, even urine. And so this is something that's actually very that is typically very easy to control in terms of transmission through the use of barrier precaution.
Okay, just like our listeners want to know that, that's the first question that anybody asks at this point, and I wanted to clear it up before we go to a break, which we now need to do, and we'll come back in a moment and continue this conversation with all of our guests and others as well. On our talking point today is the fast food industry, including McDonald's, on the path to unionization. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the worst epidemic of Ebola since that virus was discovered in 1976. There are three characteristics of this outbreak that make it different from those of the past. One is that it is in urban populations now, not just in remote villages, that it has crossed regional boundaries, that three countries now are suffering from this, New Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and that these are three countries that have been involved recently in very, very brutal civil wars, have very little in the way of institutions or medical facilities, and very little trust on the part of their people in either the governments or the people who show up to try to do something about this extraordinary disease. Jeremy Ude is an associate professor of political science at the Department of University of Minnesota, Duluth. He's author of Global Health Governance. Jeremy Ude, good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, if you will, what the World Health Organization has been able to do in these three countries to try to overcome what we heard described as these terrible, brutal civil wars that have left such a terrible legacy.
Sure. Well, under the International Health Regulation, that's a treaty that went into effect in 2007, when there's a human case of Ebola that's found, that triggers a country to make a report to the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization can really start to mobilize resources, try to bring people in, try to bring some sort of collaboration together with various partners. And so what we've seen, that's a lot of what we've seen happening so far. So we've seen earlier this month, we saw the World Health Organization convene a meeting in Accra, Ghana, of regional health ministers throughout West Africa to try to build some collaboration, try to come up with some uniform policies, or at least some uniform procedures, as Laura Garrett was mentioning before. We've also seen the World Health Organization just recently open up a sub-regional command center so that they could have a bit more of a presence on the ground and help to try to direct those resources closer to where the outbreak is happening, as opposed to just being in Geneva.
How do they propose to deal with the kinds of cultural issues that we heard about earlier, people who don't trust the government, don't trust the health workers that come in? And as I understand it, too, in many cases, and I think we heard a hint of this earlier in the program, are concerned that this may not really be a disease at all, but rather something that someone is trying to impose on them.
Right, and I think this is one of the big issues that the World Health Organization faces, or any sort of organization faces, when they're trying to transmit this sort of international response to something that's happening on the ground. So, you know, there are various efforts to try to reach out and do education campaigns, and there are also various efforts to try to make sure that there's some sort of involvement with local community leaders, trying to get people who have a sense of credibility on the ground to be able to have some outreach. We've also seen some other efforts that haven't necessarily been coming through the World Health Organization, but seem to be able to at least reach out to people. So one thing that's happened is we've seen a song that's become really popular and has been a way, and the song is giving people information about how the disease is spread, how it's transmitted, steps people can take to try to prevent becoming infected. And that can be an effective tool because it doesn't rely on people necessarily being literate, and because it's not necessarily coming directly from the government, it may not necessarily have that same sort of stigma that may be attached if it's coming out as a public service announcement from government officials or coming from outsiders who have no experience or context with the local community.
Does the World Health Organization have sufficient resources to really be able to help these countries?
The World Health Organization itself doesn't really have a lot of resources, and that's something that in part is by design, but we've also seen in the last few years the World Health Organization's budget has been decreasing, and so the resources that they have to respond to these sorts of emergencies are going down. So with the World Health Organization, they may not necessarily have the financial resources. What they try to bring is a sense of moral authority to be able to bring various partners on board, try to bring a sense of collaboration, bring people together to try to work on these sorts of issues. And also then trying to serve as an information hub so that they are collecting information, they're distributing information so that we can have a sense of here's what we know about this outbreak at the given time.
Jeremy Ude at the University of Minnesota, an author of Global Health Governance. Claire McDougall, back to you, our first guest, our journalist based in Monrovia, Liberia. What have you seen in the way of the government trying to get a handle on this? And are the Liberian officials able to deal with it, or are they completely dependent on outsiders?
Well, I guess, so over the weekend, the president announced the setting up of a joint task force, and that was donors and the government working together, and they met on Saturday and they also met on Tuesday. And, you know, there were certain orders made, such as that the borders be closed, that testing centres be established at borders that are still open. You know, at the airport, incoming and outgoing passengers are going to be screened. There's going to be a restriction on public gatherings. There's even been talk about school closure. It's mandatory for entertainment centres to screen awareness videos at the moment. There's also been talk about quarantining, you know, communities, which hasn't sort of, you know, come into effect or hasn't gone any further. So, I mean, the government is taking it seriously, but, you know, the healthcare system here is very broken, and it is, to a certain extent, dependent on donors. And, you know, this effort, I mean, if we look at who has been taking the lead role in this effort, it's been organisations like Samaritan's Purse and Médecins Sans Frontières, rather than the Ministry of Health itself.
And does the government have the authority or the resources to enforce limits on public gatherings and quarantines and borders?
Well, with the borders, I mean, we've been discussing before, is that, you know, the borders are incredibly porous, and you know, it's impossible for them to sort of close off all of the borders. You know, but there are main borders, you know, that have been closed. I think, you know, enforcement is going to be difficult. The public gatherings thing will be probably quite difficult as well. But I mean, if it's in Monrovia itself, I think that the authorities may be able to handle that.
In Monrovia, but what about in the bush?
In the bush, I think that's going to be a lot more difficult. I mean, there are a lot of areas that are unpoliced, and that, you know, there are very few police officers or security forces there. So I think it will be very difficult outside of Monrovia.
Laura Garrett, back to you with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. You're a specialist in epidemics. How concerned are you that this one might get under control, out of control?
Well, it is out of control already. So you're probably asking, will it get out of control beyond the three countries it's in? The biggest concern I would have in the near future would be if it took hold in a real sense in either Nigeria or Senegal. These are the neighboring countries that have serious international travel, much denser populations, and are, you know, trade centers for all of West Africa, and in the case of Nigeria, for the whole world in terms of the oil sector. So the thing I would really be watching for is whether any case actually results in a secondary spread in either of those countries. We already had one individual travel to Nigeria and die in Nigeria, but no evidence of secondary transmission. So as far as we know, no Nigerians got infected as a result of that individual case. But if we see something like that occur, then I think, first of all, you're going to see the level of global panic rise appreciably. You'll see trade affected, international travel affected, and everything will just ratchet up to a level of almost hysterical response, particularly in Africa, but also with the key trading partners of either Nigeria or Senegal. In the case of Nigeria, that would be the Anglophile response. In the case of Senegal, it would be the Francophones.
On the other hand, as we heard earlier from Dr. Fisher, it's not all that easy for Ebola to transfer from one person to another. It requires the interaction with fluids in the body rather than being passed through the air. Would reassurances about that, do you think, be helpful with regard to holding off global panics?
Oh, I would hope so, but my goodness, you can see the way people are responding. Just do hashtag Ebola on Twitter and look at the kinds of crazy things people are saying. We're already getting a kind of global response as this is building that's akin to the kinds of hysteria I've seen with any number of other diseases in the past. We need a lot more government education
and statements to the public to reassure people, and more, I would say, demonstration of what biosafety and hospital safety look like. And of course, this comes at a bad time because WHO is in its third budget cycle of severe redlining in their budget, 20% layoffs, $1.2 billion budget deficit. CDC is under investigation from the U.S. Congress for two lapses, major lapses in biosafety. The NIH was recently discovered to have lost track of more than a dozen test tubes dating back to the 1950s, five or six of which contained live smallpox virus. So we have some credibility issues to deal with, even on our side. Now, none of these are as huge as the credibility problems that Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is facing in Liberia or her counterparts in Guinea and Sierra Leone. But believe me, if this were to take hold in Nigeria and in a place like Lagos, which is chaos writ large, you would see a global response that would be considerably bigger than anything we've seen so far.
So, Jeremy Yude, let me go back to you. Your book is Global Health Insurance, Governance. What about global health confidence? And is this the time for the World Health Organization to be jacking up the budget in order to try to spread the word that this isn't necessarily something that people need to worry about in the way that they might?
Well, I'm sure ideally the World Health Organization would love to increase its budget and have that. The problem has been that the member states of the World Health Organization have resisted, essentially since the 1980s, to increase the dues that they pay the World Health Organization. So any additional money that's coming into the World Health Organization has to be specifically designated by the donor states for specific purposes. So what they would need, if they need money, if they want resources in order to help provide that sort of message, they need to get donor states to specifically give money to the World Health Organization and say this is for Ebola outreach or this is for Ebola control efforts or something along those lines. They don't have the resource or the ability to raise those resources directly on their own.
Claire McDougall, back to you in Monrovia, Liberia. Is there a stigma attached even to those people who have recovered from Ebola? Is that part of the problem?
I think that is a significant problem. There was a doctor who was a doctor from Bong County, a hospital there, who recently was left hospital and he'd survived. And he was talking about the newspaper article, and that I haven't actually directly interviewed him myself yet. But he spoke about the incredible stigma, and he's a doctor. I imagine what it's like for people in the rural areas or in small communities in the rural areas, and some of the people that I spoke with who were survivors were very scared about going back to their communities and very concerned about how they might be received. So I think there is a significant amount of stigma, and it is a new experience for Liberia. It's a new illness for Liberia, so many people don't understand it, and there's a lot of suspicion around what's going on. So I think the issue of stigma is going to be something that that health workers and the Ministry of Health is going to have to address in helping reintegrate people back into their communities.
And Dr. William Fisher at the University of Carolina, once again, North Carolina, you were in Guinea trying to work in what looks like a spacesuit at 115 or 116 degree temperatures, trying to deal with this. Were there also practices that people pursue in these areas where you were that involve coming into contact with the bodily fluids of people who have Ebola, living and dead? Was that one of the issues and one of the causes of spread?
Absolutely. So transmission, we often saw that transmission resulted from certain cultural or religious practices, such as washing the body prior to burial, without the benefit of without the protection of barrier precaution. And so what was typically a tradition or a ritual often became a foci of transmission for this virus, and that certainly makes this much more difficult to control.
So there's a huge educational issue there, it would seem to me. What do you think happened to survivors where you were? Were they accepted back into the community or not?
So I was told that survivors were met with both reactions. Some celebrated the arrival of somebody who had survived, and others were very fearful. And so actually part of the reintegration process by the MSF personnel would be to accompany the survivor to their village, and then to try to educate everyone in that village about how this person is not infectious anymore, or about which body fluids they still need to avoid.
How would you say this might be dealt with in the United States? Would you feel confident that it could be controlled and not necessarily spread?
I do. And actually, I think I want to jump back to something that Lori Garrett said, which I think was brilliant, is that I think the biggest concern is Nigeria and or Senegal, mainly because they don't, for the very reason why this outbreak is out of control in West Africa, is because they don't have the resources in that are necessary to mobilize and isolate a person who's infected. Whereas in the United States or a place like Europe, if somebody becomes infected and is recognized, importantly, then we have the resources at hand to quickly isolate that person and provide them with the best possible care so that we can give them every chance to not only improve but to limit the ability to transmit to other people.
So, Jeremy Yud, back to you. What are the prospects, do you think, of spreading education about this, given the lack of resources on the part of the World Health Organization? Do you think there might be a change in this as a result of this outbreak? Is there anything going on that you're aware of at the UN, for example?
I haven't heard much about efforts that would substantially increase the World Health Organization's budget or change how countries are approaching the idea about increasing their membership dues. What I think might happen, though, is we can see some good collaborations that could happen between the World Health Organization and non-governmental organizations. As the other guests have mentioned, groups like Samaritan's Purse have played a really important role, and also Doctors Without Borders, in providing actual care on the ground. And so building those sorts of collaborations may be a way of trying to get around some of those resource limitations that WHO itself has.
So, Lori Garrett, does that give you some reason for at least some measure of optimism?
Well, I always try to be a little optimistic about things, but I have to say that it's really been quite appalling to watch how much nonchalance the struggle of WHO for budget and authority has been greeted with. It's almost as if the whole world community just doesn't quite see the point anymore. And if it weren't for WHO, I don't know who we would be turning to. Similarly, CDC's budget has been cut and cut and cut, particularly for its global threat response. And I really don't know what members of Congress imagine would be our defense in the absence of a viable, strong, internationally oriented CDC.
I think all our listeners on this program have gotten the point. Thank you all very much for being with us. Lori Garrett again at the Council on Foreign Relations, her book Betrayal of Trust, The Collapse of Global Public Health. Thanks to Jeremy Yud at the University of Minnesota Duluth, author of Global Health Governance. Dr. William Fisher at the University of North Carolina, who was deployed to Guinea on behalf of the World Health Organization, and Claire McDougall, our journalist based in Monrovia, Liberia. Good to have all of you. Thanks so much. When fast food workers demand higher pay from McDonald's, the corporate office says, take that up with the individual franchise owners. That's not our problem. Now, the National Labor Relations Board says the corporation is responsible after all. Will that pave the way for unionization? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day, and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. The National Labor Relations Board General Counsel has ruled that corporate McDonald's is a joint employer along with its 14,000 franchisees. That comes after 20 months of complaints against franchises all over the country. If it's upheld by the full board, it could ease the way for unionization nationwide. That's according to Stephen Greenhouse, who's labor and workplace reporter for the New York Times. Always good to have you on our program.
Always nice to be here, Warren.
Good. Tell us a bit more about the ruling before we get into the prospects of whether it will be upheld by the National Labor Relations Board.
So the Labor Board's General Counsel issued this terse two-paragraph announcement saying essentially that McDonald's is a joint employer with its franchisees. And what does that mean? I guess it would mean that it's jointly liable for any wrongdoing that the franchisees commit regarding, say, wage laws or for illegally firing someone for supporting a union. And reading between the lines, the NLRB's general counsel must have thought that McDonald's has such close close control over how the franchisees run that McDonald's owns a lot of the restaurants. It kind of trains a lot of the workers. It helps set schedules for a lot of the franchisees. And the general counsel basically said, you're a joint employer. You're responsible for what goes on there. And McDonald's and the nation's business community is very unhappy, partly because it is likely to open the door to faster unionization.
And it sounds like more government regulation.
Yes. I've been flooded with statements from various business groups that say this is the liberal leftist Obama board carrying the water of organized labor and hurting small businesses. I do think that, this ruling will make it easier for, say, the fast food workers to unionize McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King. Why do I say that? Now that McDonald's has been declared a joint employer, McDonald's can no longer just say, hey, wages at our 14,000 restaurants are set by franchisees. We don't have anything to do with it, because the unions can say, wait, you've been declared to be a joint employer. And they could say, if you McDonald's don't help raise wages, don't, stop fighting unionization, we are going to really step up the pressure, not just on the franchisees, but on you. We might, run, corporate campaigns, advertising campaigns, making you look bad, hurting you in the public's eye, so that you better, in response, help lift wages or maybe agree not to fight a union.
People who are worried about their own economic situation might be patronizing McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King, but there's no way you can argue those are small businesses, is there?
McDonald's certainly isn't a small business, and some of its franchisees are small businesses. They just own two or three, but there are other franchisees that own 10 to 20 restaurants, and it's hard to say that they're small. They're small businesses. Both McDonald's and its franchisees, seem to agree and are saying that McDonald's is not a joint employer. They're saying that McDonald's really doesn't, hold the franchisee's hand and jointly determine, say, hiring decisions and firing decisions and employee hours. On the other hand, the fast food workers who brought these cases against McDonald's say that McDonald's really, has firm rules, on how its franchisees should operate, about cleanliness, about food, about how things are to be prepared, and that, McDonald's rules, they say, leave franchisees with very little money and forces them to pay workers not very, very much money. And there's this whole movement that we've discussed before, Warren, to create a $15 wage floor at McDonald's and other fast food restaurants. And the Service Employees Union, which has underwritten this effort, has been very eager to see McDonald's declared a joint employer, because now it feels this decision can help force McDonald's to the table to maybe negotiate some rules about first steps towards unionizing some or perhaps many McDonald's restaurants.
How likely is the NLRB to make good on what appears to be the nightmare of some businesses and uphold this ruling with all the implications that you've described?
I'd say there's a pretty good chance, Warren. The general counsel of the NLRB, Richard Griffin, is a pretty liberal guy, and there's a liberal majority on the board right now. The bigger question is whether the federal appeals courts, which are generally more conservative, will overturn this McDonald's ruling. There's another case right now before the five-person board involving a recycling firm in California, Browning Ferris in California. And Browning Ferris was using a staffing firm, a temp agency, to provide workers at one of its recycling plants. And the NLRB is going to, the five-person board, as opposed to the general counsel, is going to decide whether Browning Ferris, which uses the temp agency, is a joint employer with the temp agency. And again, Browning Ferris is worried that if that happens, it will make it easier to unionize Browning Ferris. It will make it responsible for any wage violations by the temp agency. So companies really don't like this rule, and they're resisting it very hard.
What would be the mechanism whereby workers could unionize McDonald's, for example? How would they go about it, and what would their action then be subject to challenge by in the courts?
They could go about it in several ways, Warren. Again, we've watched these Fight for 15 fast food demonstrations. I think, many individual franchises can be unionized overnight. I think there are a lot of franchisees, without 30 workers, and it's easily to get a majority of, 16, 17 in favor of the union. But I think the Service Employees Union that is pushing for this really doesn't want to organize restaurants in onesies and twosies. It wants 20s and 40s and 100s. So I think it's really hoping to pressure McDonald's, through the strikes, through billboards, through marches, to kind of set some ground rules with McDonald's, in which McDonald's would kind of pledge not to fight a unionization effort for to get a so-called neutrality agreement. And I think that having McDonald's declared a joint employer, will help force McDonald's to the table. McDonald's will, doesn't want to go to the table to try to refuse it, and the SAU will try to mount as much pressure as possible on McDonald's to get it to the table to set some ground rules for potential unionization.
You mentioned Wendy's and Burger King, too, but is McDonald's being singled out as a target by the union and organized labor?
Yes. McDonald's, as we all know, is kind of the 800-pound gorilla in the fast food industry, and the SEIU, the fast food workers, think, well, if we could, pressure them enough, maybe tarnish their image enough, and, get them to let us unionize them, then, the smaller companies, Wendy's, Burger King, will then follow suit, and there'll be unionization there. But it won't be easy.
Okay. At the same time, of course, as you mentioned, there's this fight for $15 an hour going on in various cities, and we'll see how that goes as well. Stephen Greenhouse, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks so much for telling us more about this ruling by the General Counsel, not so far the whole board, the whole Labor Relations Board, in the McDonald's case. Thanks again.
Always nice to be here.
Stephen Greenhouse, labor and workplace reporter for The New York Times. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.